I'm here at Sadie Cole's HQ with Sarah Lucas at her new show, Bunny Gets Snookered. Sarah likes to confront us with outrageous associations. Let's start with the title of the show, Bunny Gets Snookered.
Well, I made an edition of arm sculptures with my arms interlocking in snooker ball colours, just because I needed I fancied bringing a bit of colour into my work for one thing, and I thought it would be good to have a limit on the number I did, and there's 8 snooker ball colours, so I thought, well, that would be quite nice. And since then, I've sort of been on the lookout for things that could be made into editions in that way, and most things you make aren't really suitable. They make one of them, and because of something in the nature of the way they're made, they're not really repeatable. But when I made the first one of these, I thought, well, yeah, I could do something with these, because you've got possibilities with the colours of the stockings and that kind of thing. And I thought it would be a really funny thing to make in snooker ball colours, especially as they are all handmade. It's not an addition. It's not one mould or something. So that's really where it came from. And then I thought, well, it's actually really funny, the whole idea of the snooker thing with these bunnies, because it does have that sexual connotation. So I thought I'd call it Bunny Gets Snookered.
Okay, we're looking first of all here at the triptych you've done here, the black and white bunnies, and these photographic works, and they're quite surreal. Is this an influence on your work, surrealism at all? Or?
Yeah, I'd say it is. I'd say it's something I've always had a sort of interest in, and it's quite a nostalgic interest by now, but it was something I was very impressed by when I was a teenager. And I like that kind of odd quality, because I think it makes you think a bit. But then there's always something accidental in my work. I actually took these pictures to use up a bit of film I had on the end of a roll of film, and they just worked out a lot better than I expected. So that's why there's so much incidental stuff in the background and a lot of Angus's work.
So you took them in your studio?
Yeah, because I share a studio with Angus.
Okay, so if we move to the largest piece here, which is this glorious snooker table with the two chairs on it. Can you describe this work and also why you use the snooker table and how it relates to the main body of your work, in fact?
Well, the snooker table isn't part of the work. We just hired it because we thought it would help with the installation. Kind of goes back to the previous show where I was thinking there's certain things you can introduce almost just to be themselves, like the car, which when you saw it wasn't working. In a way, it was sort of irrelevant whether it works or not. I mean, I suppose it's more of an artwork if it works, but it adds a lot, quite a flavour to the whole thing. In any case, because these bunnies are all round about the same height, I thought that to have 8 of them in here all at the same height would maybe not be as dramatic as it could be. And since it had already the idea of the snooker thing and the snooker ball colours, I thought that would be the ideal thing to introduce for a bit of variation.
Yeah, they do look marvellous when you walk in and you see them all spread on the chairs, and also the different chairs you've used. Mm. Again, an incidental thing with these chairs that you just found.
Well, I mean, I could have gone and tried to find an appropriate chair and just buy 8 of them. I don't like that sort of standardisation. I actually think, and also, you know, say I'd gone and bought 8 brand new chairs or something, I actually think I tend to use odd-bod stuff and stuff that's sort of doesn't particularly have a value, so they're not worth £100 each already or whatever. They're sort of valueless, and I think the fact that they're all different is in a way because it doesn't matter what chair it is. But again, that introduces another thing about the colour and the texture, and because none of the chairs are particularly new, that helps the sleazy aspect.
And it definitely does, and also I think people start to make associations because you've got kind of office chairs and bar chairs and working man's cafe chairs.
Exactly. Well, exactly, yeah.
So. Kind of all the different situations that you've often dealt with in your work. Also, if we just look at the actual bunnies themselves, the way you've constructed them, the kind of legs and the whole thing. I mean, what stimulated you to do that?
It goes back a long time, actually. In 1993, when me and Tracy had the shop, I made an octopus out of tights, stuffed with newspaper. And I was thinking, I liked it a lot, and I thought, well, what else could I make with tights? And I mean, 3 months after that, I was thinking about making a tortoise and a hare, and I was going to make the hare out of tights. Which I started doing at the time. I was stuffing them in newspaper, and I did put wires in the legs, and it never really worked out. I was using sort of grey tights and, like I say, newspaper and stuff, but there was something that came to life about the legs, but the whole thing never really quite worked, so I just dropped it. And when I came to do this, to be thinking about the show in St John's Lofts, I don't know, I just sort of, the idea occurred to me again of making a kind of hair, but making it much more feminine and having stockings and things. Putting it on the chair was actually a complete accident. I just put it on a chair I had handy because to see how the legs were working so I could sort of bend them about and stuff. And suddenly the whole thing was just going on, so then I took it from there and attached the ears to the chair, and something had obviously just happened. So
Fact that they're actually attached to the chair, I mean, do you think people will make kind of associations, this object, this feminine object kind of clamped down to the chair in some way? I mean, is that something that's just incidentally happened?
Well, I mean,
with the piece?
It did happen kind of by accident, but on the other hand, I've used a lot of furniture in my work and often use the furniture as a stand-in for the body. So in this case, it doesn't quite stand in for the body, but it does in the chest area. And it's at the same time as helping the bunny, to support the bunny, it also brings the chair to life in a certain way, and they sort of become indispensable to each other. So, I mean, I think that happens in a lot of work. I've used, generally speaking, it's been with tables.
And also, I mean, I love the way, as you said at the beginning, that you use the tights are related to the snooker balls as well.
Yeah.
And so you've got this lovely contrast of these kind of red stockings and the blue stockings and the black stockings. Were you pleased with the way that kind of worked? You know,
yeah,
having
of course.
Had that idea.
I mean, actually, there was quite a lot of scope because I could have looked for certain colour chairs or painted the chairs, and likewise with the clamps, I could have had those the same colours. And in the end, I thought better and sort of more casual just to stick with the stockings, although some of them I mean the blue one is holy blue, for instance, and the pink one doesn't have any stockings on.
Holy blue, was there any reason for that?
I just fancied it, but I thought there's something, well, I suppose there's that whole thing of blue movies for a start, but there's that whole kind of melancholy feeling that the blue has as an association, so I thought it would be interesting to do that, and I didn't really want them to all be too kind of samey.
And also, I was just interested as well, snooker and its associations. You often play with these kind of stereotypes, or you do always play with these stereotypes in your work, the male domain, etc. Mm. I mean, are you considering this in this piece as well? Because you mentioned about the height of the chairs and everything, but there's also, you can get some wonderful kind of playful associations,
yeah,
around the game and, you know, women's role in the game,
yeah,
etc.
Well, really, I just stick to very simple things. I mean, people say, well, it's to do with the maleness, or all of those things play a part, but mostly I just try and choose simple things to work with that everybody knows about, that are sort of fairly common, so that I know where I am, and then it's just surprising how many meanings tend to converge on that.
Do you find that exciting when people put all these meanings? Because,
oh, yeah.
I mean,
absolutely.
They really do.
And I find
it
exciting in my own head when that, yeah, starts to happen. Because you choose something, like I say, the snooker table, for quite practical reason. And it's sort of, the purposefulness of it seems to grow, and the associations seem to grow. So
I just started thinking about smoking when I saw the snooker table, and, you know, all the kind of smoky areas where you see people,
yeah,
playing snooker. And,
yeah,
I kind of thought it was about that.
Well, and it gives you a feeling. I mean, if you're in the gallery here, it's completely white, and you're in here during the daytime. But having the snooker table here puts you in mind of a more evening time situation, a more inside kind of, yes, like you say, smoky, more sleazy environment.
Drinking.
Yeah, illicit.
Yes, illicit kind of things.
I always think that the sexier work, for instance, these bunnies, or the bitch piece, or the two fried eggs and a kebab, I always think people feel my presence much more strongly in those pieces than in perhaps the smoking things, or things with less of a sexual element. I think I'm still, like you say, very heavily associated with things because it is to do with sexuality, and people immediately wonder what my position is in that. But I think, from my point of view, with all my work, I'm operating from inside it somehow, not really making things that are that separate from me. They're all about things that I do, really, or that I'm involved in, so that's very much from inside, one way or the other.
I don't think we can talk about your work without talking about smoking and the dominance that there has in a lot of your work.
Well, it's been a recent theme, definitely, since the last couple of years or something.
Is there any reason why that's become more dominant?
I think since I turned 30, I'd started to think more about decaying and eventually dying. But also I've started to feel more the effects in my body of the kind of lifestyle I live. When I do smoke a lot, I do drink a lot, so suffer a lot more from hangovers, get more coughs. And I started to think about the self-destructiveness of that, how bizarre it is to be doing something so self-destructive and sort of enjoying it. I sort of intrigued by the contradiction of those things. So, and it's a very good metaphor for all those kinds of things. On the one hand, the decay, and on the other hand, the pleasure you take in doing it, or the kind of relief it is from. I mean, you smoke for the distraction from what you're doing a lot of the time. I might be making something and I want to take a break, so I'll take a cigarette. So on the one hand, you do it for relief, and on the other hand, it's destroying you probably. So it's like it's going to cost you sooner or later all that relief you took. You know, it's a bit like that.
I mean, people read into it political statements as well about smoking and anti-smoking campaigns.
Well, I mean, all that stuff I think is less important in a way, but it is funny because it is relevant at the moment. And that whole idea of, yeah, whether you've got the freedom to smoke and, or whether other people have got the freedom to be free of your smoke and all that kind of stuff. I mean, all those things, I sort of agree with both sides on that, really. I think you shouldn't have to be choking on other people's fags. But on the other hand, I'm not really pro any kind of censorship on anything. But another thing I sometimes think about smoking is that I do it to actually dampen down my passion, in a way, in that same way that you smoke when you're nervous, or, you know, which always strikes me as a funny thing to do as well.
Can we talk a little bit about why, in your practice, perhaps you have always had this great interest in this kind of underbelly, this kind of laddish culture? I mean, is that for any particular reason?
I mean, I just grew up with it. I suppose I was quite a tomboy when I was a teenager, although I went to an all-girls school.
But that's
maybe it's something to do with that.
I think it probably is.
I was daytime completely surrounded by women, and in the evening I tend to hang around with this crowd of blokes. I got very used to their kind of opinions and reactions and the kind of things they would say. I'm sure it's like this for most people. You don't have to be a tomboy to understand something of what goes on in the opposite sex's mind. But I don't know, it took me in a very strange way that I'd always think what they would thought was funny, but at the same time it would make me more self-conscious because I'd know that I could easily be the butt of that particular joke or something. So I found myself in that kind of self-conscious position, and I think that's very much the position that I make things from. And when I talk about being inside the work, that's really what I mean. I'm as self-conscious about it as the next person. I'm not sort of sitting on high making these things or lecturing anybody on how they should be. I'm thinking, well, this is the kind of push and pull that I'm in. But I always enjoyed it a lot as well, all that kind of humour and just the kind of remarks. I mean, I still like the way people use language, and especially people with sometimes quite limited vocabulary, but manage to say a great deal. It's almost like poetry or singing in the way that if you've got a song, the tune adds a great deal of meaning to what's being said, and you actually, if you were to write the lyrics down like poetry and just read them, they sound quite stupid, but with the music they sound fantastic. And I think there's something about that with language, and in anybody's particular, where they grew up, there's something about different accents that has a kind of singing quality that's especially meaningful to that you identify with very strongly your own. So I've always enjoyed that.
A lot of critics have talked about your pose, this particular pose you have with your jacket. You're not wearing your jacket today, it's too hot. But this pose you have with the boots. And can you talk a little bit about how this developed? I mean, is this how you've always been?
I mean, I've always dressed in a fairly androgynous way. I wouldn't say I in any way try and look masculine, but I don't wear anything particularly feminine. I don't feel comfortable in, like, floral prints or anything. But the funny thing is, it's sort of an accident. I actually do photograph much more masculine looking than I think I look in real life.
You do?
and that just happens. So, I mean, obviously I've begun to exploit that. But initially that was just something I hated, actually. I'd hate all photographs of me. As a teenager, I would never have a photograph taken of me. For that reason, I always thought, God, I look so butch, I look like my little brother. So I sort of steered clear of it. But the first self-portrait was in the picture of me eating a banana. And in that picture, I mean, I sort of took those pictures for a laugh. I wasn't expecting it to be as potent as it was. And of course, something happened, which was that it was completely different from a pornographic picture, because I did look so androgynous and confrontational. And I suddenly realised, I suppose, or gradually realised, the scope for just the potency of that, really. And it's also had the useful purpose to me of making me less self-conscious in pictures. Because as long as it's a good picture, it doesn't matter if I think I look masculine. So it actually has a sort of knock-on effect to my own feeling about myself, which is quite handy. But, I mean, really, I don't feel entirely as if the toughness or the laddishness is particularly the point. But I think there is something very potent about perhaps doing things that could be provocative in the way that women are often exploited in a sexy way. And just because I look masculine, it doesn't come across like that. I think that's interesting. And it's not particularly cliched. I mean, I don't wear sort of workman's boots or I don't adopt ridiculously male poses. It's slightly more incidental than that. It's just a sort of flavour of that.
And it's almost like people take a very stereotypical view of that because you're dressing in that way.
Exactly. And this is another thing that goes on in my work, that people actually take a much more stereotypical view of it than I do, probably. Or not everybody, but some people. And in the end, well, that's up to them, but in another way, I feel that the work is working, even though it's not working necessarily in the way I'd have it work. And those people are not assessing their reaction to disentangle how much of that is them and how much of it is me. But I think that is when something's working, when it becomes problematic to disentangle what's what. And it's that kind of complexity that I think's, and ambiguity that I think is interesting. The work isn't really didactic. It's not trying to tell anybody what in particular to think. So I sort of think it's successful in that way.
The works do become actually very complex, don't they, by all the ideas that they throw out,
yeah,
and by their juxtaposition.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they're much more complicated in, because they're all very simple and quite economic, really, in terms of the construction. But there are a lot of ideas that converge on them, and a lot of what is common currency among people in terms of whether it's power relationships or jokes or gender relations or whatever else.
So the joke, you obviously love that aspect, this humour, the jokiness.
Well, to come back to the surrealism thing, you asked earlier what's my interest in surrealism. Well, in a way, I always think surrealism is like it's like a joke, but it's not the punchline. If you didn't have the punchline, what I always think is really funny about jokes is the scenario in the first place. Like you say, okay, two horses walk into a bar and ask for a pint of beer. Well, that to me is hilarious. You know, there's going to be a punchline to this. But the whole idea in the first place, and everyone's just standing there listening, totally credulous. You know, okay, two horses just gone into a bar. And there's something about that I find really hilarious. And it's the same with making an object. I mean, you make something like the bitch, and you can't help thinking how hilarious it is to have made this object. And sometimes people don't think that either. They take it so seriously. When people get annoyed, you think, well, Christ the wise, doesn't it ever occur to you that it's hilarious to make an object like that? That it's as simple as that or something, and it's as ludicrous as that. And that it's as ludicrous to call tits melons or any of that stuff that's going on.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very surreal thing, isn't it? I can see that. That's brilliant. I really want to conclude by talking about the power in your work. I think it is very powerful work. I think the language is very powerful, and I think we were really talking about that when we were talking about almost a couple of words can be a poem. And many of the words you've used in your work have a huge interactive space, really, when you look at them and they've been used against you or they're things that are funny. And I'd just like to talk a little bit about your use of words and language and that power that you create, that interactive power you create as a woman, as an artist who's been put in this kind of arena of the kind of brickpack arena of put together with people like Tracy, and that whole interaction that's happening in the art world that critics are picking up on, feminist critics, things like that, the empowerment of you. I'd just like to talk a little bit about that, if you could.
A lot of women who I've talked to about it, especially older women than me, have pointed out that things are very different for this generation of women artists than the previous generation, and that, I mean, I suppose we've got a lot more freedom, in a way. I mean, there was a lot more theory involved before, people having to carve out a space and perhaps weren't being taken so seriously, so they resorted to being very serious in a way that there's a lot more humour perhaps than what women are doing now, because they can, I don't know, because they're not having to break down those particular barriers or something.
So where do you place yourself then in women's history or histories?
One of the things that struck me as a much younger artist before, looking around at people like Warhol and Gilbert and George and even Francis Bacon and Picasso, whoever you like to do from, whoever you like to think of, I mean, it struck me that personality played a huge part in artists, especially the bigger the artist, the more their personality played a part. And that was the thing that struck me as hadn't really happened so much with women's art, and perhaps one of the reasons women hadn't been as big in art as men, there hadn't been something to do with, it must have been a social thing as well as an art thing, but somehow or other their personality didn't seem to enter into it so much, and that was something I was ambitious about, but I just hit into the right moment when enough kind of groundwork had been done by people, I suppose, to, and so now I'd say that's characteristic of my generation, that of women artists, that their personality plays a huge part. I mean, if you look at someone like Tracy, her personality is totally integral to what she does. Or Georgina.
Do you think yours is as well?
But totally, yeah. And that was what I wanted. So I think that's a big difference.
Addie Rosenblum, we're talking in Vienna, and you have a space or a gallery here, and you've recently shown in City Racing in London. Perhaps you could start by talking about this space that you have for art in Vienna.
So it was about 2 years ago that we started to do this space. I mean, before we used to do shows in empty spaces, but it became always difficult to get the spaces because the owner of the spaces were always suspicious about what kind of events we are going to do there. So we always, it's about since 7 years that we have a studio in a big studio building, and it's quite a big space. And so we decided it would be actually the best thing to do is to do out of the studio an art space. So we began, and it was 95, summer 95, we did the same, this is the first show there, and it was called Wienerwald. And we also had some artists from the Bank Group as guest artists. We invited them from London because in 94 we had a scholarship in London, and we got to know some English artists, and we really liked the situation in London. So we decided, one of the reasons why we decided to do this space is to do project where we invite people from abroad and people from Vienna and try to do things together. So, and the second show that we did there was called Living Past, and we had some artists from Israel, and then we did Oasis, and then we did Mission Impossible, and then we did The Great Divide, and now we are going to, and in between we had John Roberts, who did the dog, who curated the Dog Breath show in our space, and now we're going to have the show with people from City Racing, which is called Bongo.
How common is it in Vienna for artists to actually open their own spaces? Because this is happening a great deal now in London, and has for some time, but there are more and more new spaces being initiated or defined by artists as part of their practice.
Yeah, it's not very common here, and this was the reason why we wanted to do it, because there used to be people who did some events, some shows in some spaces, but it wasn't really a continually, and it was just like they did one or two things and then it was over. And our idea was really to try to do a real space. And the problem is, one of the reasons why we really felt the necessity to do it was that the gallery situation in Vienna is really horrible, because there are no young galleries, and all the older galleries only show very, very safe things, like, you know, only what they think that, I mean, nothing with taking risk, and no possibility for young people to show in galleries, and the institution in any ways. So that's why actually it's for young people very, very difficult to do something.
The artists that you've mentioned in the various places that you mentioned seem to suggest that you're interested in interacting with a wide international constituency of artists and galleries. Tell me about that, because it could be possible also to work just with artists from Vienna.
As I said, this was one of the things that we thought to be the most important, because Vienna, because the gallery in Vienna not really functions in a normal sense how galleries are, then there is no real exchange between artists. There are hardly any young artists who will come to Vienna just for months or for a few weeks and be around and speak to people, so it's not really a lively situation of exchange. And that's why we thought that when we create this gallery and we have the projects and the people will come over, and it's not only then just to do the show, just to meet the people and to really to try to communicate and try to exchange. So, and I think this is actually maybe the most successful part of our project, because it's we were quite astonished as we began. We started to communicate with other spaces and with other people who are doing similar projects all around Europe, and we were just astonished how easy it is to do such thing, even without money and, you know, very low budget. But the people are really, really interested, and everybody have the same idea like we have just now to have this network where you can communicate and do things very flexible, and you know, you can just stage a show in 1 month, and you don't have to plan it for 1 year before. And so this is, I think, the most successful part of the project.
Let's finish by you talking about the works that you had at City Racing, which mm-hmm. I've seen, and formerly what was actually there was quite diverse. For instance, there was one room with two individuals in static positions with spots on their bodies. There were elements against the wall, I think small Lego pieces and other things. Tell me about that project.
Yeah, we call the project Slaymobile, and there's this children game, children toys, it's a company which is called Playmobil, and it's a very certain kind of aesthetic. And so we changed one letter, and we, instead of Playmobil, it's Slaymobil. And it was this element, this cuts, these wounds and these cuts that it was all over the show. It was in the video, and it was in this tableau vivant, and it was also in the drawings. And the idea was that we try to mix some elements, some iconographic elements like these wounds, and to try to we use this makeup. It's for us like a painting that we paint on the body, so it's like and but I think Marcus should speak about it.
So Marcus Muntian, you also work with Adi here in Vienna, and you're involved in the City Racing installation or project. Can you tell me a bit more about it?
Yeah, my main purpose was just to create kind of complex structure with different layers, and we are always trying to use different mediums, like we used a video beamer, and we used kind of installation context like this tableau vivant, and also we had some drawings there, and it was just a continuous kind of theme going on with these cuts and spots, and it was kind of variations also in every room was another variation on this theme, and so it was just also dealing with classic iconographic structures like these wounds, you know, from the old masters. And this is also something that's interesting for us, just to deal with pathetic structures, and because we are interested in the pathos, and we want to find a modern version how to deal with it in a contemporary way, which in our point of view needs to have some ironic layer. So we try to be serious and ironic at the same time, and this is what I meant with to create a complex structure.
It was also another level in the installation was also we just reacted about the, because we are from Vienna and you have this Viennese actionism and this, they used to do these wounds and this card, they used to really do it, and we thought that it's just like interesting how, because we did it and it was a fake, and we just had the feeling like it's also reflecting the 90s, like it's completely another meaning. Thank you.
America. B. Bebop. C. Caesar. D. Doomsday. E. 11. F. Fly. G. Grunge. Unknown flying object. V. Various. W. Wonder. X. Xenophobia. Y. Yard. Z. Zero. Thank you.
Thank you. phobia. Realize why you're always scared of winter. Realize that the only flesh you will touch is your own. Realize why you cannot get up on tender mornings. Realize that the only flesh you ever touch is your own. Realize that half of you never rises from your bed. Realize that your sleeping skin is unbearably soft. Realize that half of you is waiting to be kissed. Realize that you are always scared to leave your bed, for that other half of you that does rise from your bed is not the half of you that is Sleeping Beauty. Realize that that half of you that never rises from your bed is the half of you that is aching to be kissed. Is that half of you is a half of you is half of you. Admit you're always awake, unbearably aware, and always dreaming to be kissed, Sleeping Beauty, but always Sleeping Beauty. Concentration is the game. Y comes after X. Malcolm, you're not the only one. Not knowing, searching, not finding, inventing Y names. They brought your people here, gave them names, not theirs. Came my people, gave us names, not ours. Why? You look at me and wonder why this chink's called Maria, Irene, Lavinia. Why? Flores, why? Diaz, why? Irene, why? Concentration. Concentration. For 100 years, Spanish. Nicaraguans, Dominicans, Puerto Ricans, Salvadorans, Filipinos. Spanish eyes. Spanish wise. Spanish lies. False claims. For Irene. Irene. Why? Why? After X. X is equation. Why is the question. Why labels all things being equal? I never understood why they called me Chinese when I was Filipino. Why white people are beige and I'm certainly not yellow. Why I am not. Why I cannot call myself what I am not. Irene. I am not anything but Irene. Why? Why Asian Pacific Islander? Why lumped together in a continental shelf? Concentration. Galleons. If not, what not, why not? By birth, birth why? Why questions? It's like the why of my ideas. XX, not XY. X for not having Y. Y not having Y. Chromosomes, maybe she's born with it. Why saved? Why cursed? Why testosterone? Why melanin? Why nicotine? Why fluoxetine? Why Maybelline? Maybe she's born with it. Why? Is the difference more than the why? Is the ID more than the difference more than the difference is more than skin deep? Why? Searching for answers before searching for questions. Why? Questions can't find Irene before those. Why? Questions I cannot find the I before the why, Irene. Why? Why? Symbols no. X on my hat. X no. X no. I don't rap. Why? Yes. Why? Yes. I ask why questions. You ask why. I ask why. I'll suck you into my why world and we can all be why. I'll be wise, I'll be wise, 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 wise to the ways of the world. Wide, 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 wide world, or be confused. Uniformly puzzled, uniformly uninformed. Let X equal Y, then proceed to more important things like asking why A's to the Q's of the Y. Why geography, why archaeology, why genealogy, why anthropology. I, a monkey, spiral ascension to elevated epistemology. Why keep asking? Why never finding? Why searching? Like all of history, inventing why? Searching, not finding, inventing. Concentration. In a name.
Say what you mean. Mean what you say. say what you mean. Mean what you say. Say something mean.